For my first guest today is Kevin O'Hara. He's an author. He's also retired a few years back from 30 years as a psych nurse. He lives in Western Massachusetts. He's written three books. I read all of them. One of them I like so much I read it twice. they're all excellent works. And with St. Patrick's Week, yes, we get a whole week these days, coming up, I want to talk with Kevin a little bit about his experience being a first-generation Irish-American living in Western Mass. And I was at the same, a little bit behind you. You're, I think, 9 years older than me, Kevin. I was a second-generation Irish-American growing up on the other side of the state. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me again, Ed.
Yeah. Hey, so I got done reading your book, A Lucky Irish Lad, and there were places that literally had me in stitches. And the one I want to talk about to kick it off here is, let's just call it your brush with near sainthood. I mean, there's Lourdes, there's Fatima, there's Knock in Ireland, holy shrines to the Blessed Virgin Mary, because some children, and in some cases adults, had visionary experiences. And that was almost you. You were almost Kevin of Pittsfield.
I came really close, for a moment there, actually for a year or two there. I thought the Blessed Mother was going to appear before me. And it all started on one of her feast days, Feast of the Assumption, August 15th. I was at Mass. It was a holy day of obligation. I was 10 years of age, and I was up at the altar. Back then, this was before Vatican II. So the priest would turn away from people, they celebrated Mass looking away from the congregation, not looking up front like they are today. And, he came around with communion, and I'll call him Father Jameson, but his real name was Father Ahern, and he had what my dad used to call the Irish jigs. He was tremulous. And to catch the host that he offered was tricky. As the altar boy used to say, it was like trying to catch a knuckleballers, or a butterfly on your tongue. And this particular, it was a Thursday, I think, or Friday, the communion, the host, the Eucharist caught just a lower lip of my lower lip. It just hung there, and God forgive me, like Jimmy Dean and, a cigarette.
So his hand was so shaky.
Then, of course,
His hand was shaky. It was that shaky that you didn't know whether the host was going to land on your tongue or, in this case, on your lip.
Right. In fact, people going up to him at communion, the men would loosen their ties and the top button, and others would stretch out their necks because they knew. Oftentimes, two heads would knock together going for the same host. That's how tremulous he was, right?
Because people are kneeling.
My dad called it the Irish jigs because
great,
he was
very
fond of
it. People are kneeling down. This is back in the day when the Mass was in Latin. People would kneel at the altar. The altar boy held a little plate underneath your chin. Yeah.
Right.
Crazy.
And so, therefore, I was left. And you would never touch the host back then. Not even the holiest nun could hold the host. And so I was struggling with it, and I was the last there. I was in the middle aisle, of the altar, and everybody watching me, the priest turning back. So I suppose some people might have been thinking I had epilepsy or something, but nobody came to my rescue. And I finally secured the host on my tongue. And just as the priest looked back to give the last blessing for the Mass, I secured the host and I went back to my seat. And the parishioners, which was shocking to me, looked at me in awe because they thought I had an apparition to Mary, the Blessed Mother.
And that's because your head was moving to try to get the host off your lip into your...
Exactly.
But they couldn't see it. They all they saw was the back of your head. They couldn't see what you were doing with your tongue.
Exactly. So, and then I came down and it was just looks of awe and admiration. In fact, one woman reached out and grabbed my pants off as I walked. And I was just so bothered by it all. I just walked right out to church, came home and started bawling my eyes out. By that time, the phone was ringing off the hook. Father Jameson had called, a few other people had called, wondering if I truly had an apparition. And of course, I'm 10 years of age, and this is the most fame I've ever had in my life, right? And my sister Mary had heard about it as well before I got home from Mass. It was like a 30-minute walk from Mass back to the house. And she basically genuflected when she saw me, right? I like that, right? So anyways, I had to come up clean, but I didn't quite know how. And Father Ahern, as his name was, said, "Mr. O'Hara, perhaps it's a prelude, because Mary, if she appeared to you suddenly, it might be just too shocked for the system. So she give you little clues beforehand, right?"
So he was hoping that you would be this that you would actually have this experience.
Oh yeah, the whole parish did.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, I was the guy, right?
Right.
I mean, here's a poor little 10-year-old who couldn't make the little league, you know, and all of a sudden I've got sainthood in my hands, right? So either way, it was a prelude, and I like that. And so I likened it to when you turn on a light and the bulb would just go pop, you know. So that's how I explained it. And, of course, some kids believed me, and many kids, there were a few in the schoolyard who did. They called me Francisco, who was one of the hopeful visionaries years ago who never saw Mary, but Lucia did, his sister did.
That was in Fatima, in Portugal,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, in Fatima. Yeah. And some would make fun of me, and others actually believed me, and they'd ask me questions. And one said, "Are you going to ask the Blessed Mother that you could make the Little League this year?" These kind of things, right? And of course, I played along with it for a while. Again, it's notoriety, a celebrity to a guy who had absolutely nothing at that time. And I'd look up at the sky and see Mary in the clouds, more or less, right? And I set up a little shrine near the footbridge, about an eighth of a mile from our house. Beautiful footbridge, actually, that's now dismantling over years. It used to belong to an old mill. But I had a little statue of Mary about an inch and a half high that kept falling from the my father's car that he had up on the dashboard with the little magnet. So I took that and wedged it into a small sampling maple tree, and I used to know there's where Mary would come to me. But I'm still waiting for her, and who knows, maybe someday she'll come around.
So at first you were in church after the experience, after wrestling with the host, you were embarrassed. That's why you kind of fled home, correct?
Oh, yeah. But, especially with the looks the parishioners were given to me, you know.
But then after you started realizing that, hey, maybe there's some fame and fortune to be had with this, maybe you believe there was the potential for an actual vision that could be the equivalent of what was experienced at Fatima and Lourdes and Knock.
Yeah, well, it nudged me enough to think that maybe I had been a chosen one, right? Yeah. And, of course, my mother consoled me, you know, because I came up with the truth. I told my brother Dermot and a few other folks, you know, my family members, that it was really the host that I was trying, and I had never caught a glimpse of Mary, you know. But still, I mean, kids in the schoolyard wouldn't forget it. And then on December 8th, another holy day of obligation, Immaculate Conception, kids were, well, the parish was there hoping that as I went to communion at this time, another celebration for Mary, that something would happen there again. And of course, I let the whole parish down. I came. It was a long walk back to my seat, because I caught the hose properly. It was a young curate named Father Lowen, who didn't have the shakes that Father Ern had, right? So anyways, I played my cards as long as I could, and of course, eventually, it was more or less forgotten, and there you go.
But you didn't. So you didn't achieve sainthood, but you did end up in a saintly line of work. You were a psych nurse at a hospital in Pittsfield. And you wrote a book about that as well.
Yeah, and that was nice. And, you know, a lot of that stems from my donkey walk. I mean, I had been a nurse for 3 or 4 years beforehand as a psych nurse. And then I went on my donkey tour. And then when I came back to the floor, well, here's one cute little story. When I came back to the floor, well, people were happy to see me, the staff and all. And there was one agitated man, a patient there, in and out of delirium. And agitated. He said, "What's all the fuss about? What's the bother here?" So I went out to him. I said, "I'm just back here on the Jones wing, back on the floor, after walking a donkey 1,700 miles around the coast of Ireland." He looked at me with a tear forming in his eye, and he said, "Don't worry, son. When I first came in here, I thought I was Teddy Roosevelt." So why would he believe me, right?
Yeah, right.
But when I went back, there were a lot of restraints and seclusions. Things got hard. There were a lot of hard asses, like Nurse Ratchets, you know. There were a couple of them on our floor, tough nurses, you know. They should have been working in the prisons, you know. And they were very quick with the needle. So I had learned during my donkey travels that Missy, my donkey, was fabulous with racehorses, you know, that were really kind of wild and ready to go all the time. And she was also a guard, and she actually could go into a field where there'd be a racehorse or two galloping around and would settle them down by just her mere humble presence. So when I went back to the floor, after learning this, I asked Eileen Myers, a wonderful boss that I had, if I could basically become a donkey nurse, be more out with the milieu and the patients rather than inside, and just kind of keep in peace. And it really worked. And about 2 or 3 years later, we were the lowest restraints and seclusions in the entire state of Massachusetts, and we got a really nice award for it. We actually went a year and a half without having to restrain one patient. And I tell you, there were some wild stallions in our field.
Yeah.
You know?
Wow.
But it all came from Missy and the donkey travels, how good she was in kind of settling people down.
So how does a first-generation Irish-American who almost achieved sainthood, who walked 1,700 miles around the perimeter of Ireland, how does he celebrate St. Patrick's Day?
Well, actually, it's not too bad. I mean, in the early days, sure enough, I'd be out there, right, with my pints, you know. But there's a couple of nice pubs here. We have Patrick's Pub, and then we have the Heritage in Lenox. And lunch, probably for Belita and I, where I might have a jar or two. But in the evening, there'd be music somewhere. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes, I do get readings. See, when you write a few Irish-themed books, nobody knows you except for one crunch weekend. That's in the middle of March, just like yourself and your music, right?
Right, yeah.
So everybody wants a piece of you during this time. So I'm going to be quite busy again next week, starting actually on Sunday on the 15th.
Yeah, and that's why
I'll probably go until the 22nd or so.
Yeah, that's why instead of St. Patrick's Day, why don't we have St. Patrick's Month? We should have a whole month. Right.
Well, we're getting a week. We're getting a week now, Ed.
I know.
I think a week is solidified.
Let's keep pushing for it.
Yeah.
No. Hey, I one other story from your Lucky Irish Lad book that I just want to reflect on for a second is, and I'm really glad that this doesn't happen anymore, but trucks used to come through neighborhoods during the day and spray for mosquitoes, and it still happens in some places. We don't have it in our neighborhood in Des Moines. There are some parts of Des Moines where it does happen. But when I was a kid, they used to spray by helicopter, and I remember being coated with malathion, who knows what that stuff was that was coming down on kids during the day while we're out playing. They're spraying the community for mosquitoes. And if I have any problems at all, I always attribute them to that experience. But you took it to another step. You actually would run behind the spray truck and make a game out of it.
Oh, kidding. It was the best time. It turned our whole neighborhood into a smokehouse. I mean, like something you'd see in, at the carnival. It was a Navy fogger. It had four thick nozzles, and it just jetted out fog. It was a mixture of xylene, DDT, and carbon dioxide that occasionally they would blow fire 4-foot flames from it. And as soon as it came through up the street, very slowly, it would slowly come up the street. You couldn't see your neighbor 10 feet away. That's how thick it was. We get on our bicycles and follow it as far as we could until we warbled into somebody's yard and basically collapsed.
So you really would feel the effects of it that quickly. How come you're not dead of cancer?
Gee whiz, here I am. I'm 77 next month, and I tell you, I have two great perfect lungs. You know? Well, who knows? See, that's because Mary came to me.
Oh, there you go. That's it. You have to give.
There's where the sink.
Right. Give thanks.
I don't brag about it anymore that I have my woman up top, you know, my dear lady. Just
give thanks to the priest with the jiggly hand.
Yeah, I know. How about it?
Yeah.
Hey, it's funny. Go ahead.
Well, we got to run to a short break here, Kevin. I really appreciate it. Join and stick around for a minute. But when we come back, I'm going to be talking with Sarah Davis. Later in the program, we will be talking about pesticides and cancer and somewhat positive news on that front. We'll also be talking about some court rulings, some gone one way, some gone another way. But my guest this segment has been Kevin O'Hara, author of A Lucky Irish Lad, The Last of the Donkey Pilgrims, and the name of the third book, Kevin?
Ins and Outs of a Locked Ward.
Yeah, great. Hey, Kevin, thanks for joining us.